It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. The month of January saw a surge in layoff announcements across the country in industries like technology, finance, and retail. Last month in Wisconsin, nearly 2,000 workers were told that they are losing their jobs. The hardest hit industries? Healthcare and telecommunications. Layoffs are becoming increasingly common as companies seek to cut costs and implement more automation. But that doesn't make them any easier to deal with for the thousands of workers facing unemployment in a difficult labor market. Our next guest has practical advice for what to do if layoffs come to your workplace. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you recently lost a job? How did you handle that situation? What do you wish you'd known when you first got the news? Or if you're in the middle of a layoff at your workplace, what questions do you have about navigating that process? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Alexia Kulwick is an associate professor and department co-chair in the School for Workers at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in labor, labor relations, and employment law. Alexia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Why do you think we're having so many layoffs right now? We're seeing a lot of it at this time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think overall we still have a pretty low unemployment rate. I think we saw some, particularly in tech, perhaps overhiring during and right after the pandemic. You mentioned healthcare in Wisconsin. To sort of be more local, I think that we're really seeing revenue problems in a lot of our communities throughout Wisconsin. And they just have not been able to maintain the level of care that they wanted to in these healthcare facilities in Wisconsin. So it's interesting that has been the hardest hit here, because we've seen for a while that they were short-staffed and they really didn't have the revenue to improve services and serve their communities better. So I think that's probably why we're seeing it in healthcare here.
Some people say that layoffs are contagious. Do you think that's the case? Do you think we're seeing that play out with this most recent wave?
You know, I don't think that's what we're seeing here in Wisconsin, given the couple of more highly publicized, I guess, layoffs that we've seen in Wisconsin. I think nationally, there can be something to that within industries where companies may see it, that in fact, another company is doing large number of layoffs to cut costs and sort of become leaner. I think there is a little bit of concern that then, you know, a competitor will have a competitive advantage. And so maybe it is a bit in certain industries like tech, a bit quote unquote contagious, right? I think it's possible.
In terms of legal options, how does getting laid off differ from being fired or quitting? What's the difference?
Yeah. So the huge difference is, of course, that if you are laid off, presuming you are a covered employee under your state's unemployment insurance law, you're entitled to uninsurance benefits. That's not going to be true if you've quit your position, and it's not going to be true if you were fired for a serious infraction or for cause from your place of employment. As far as layoffs go, there also are some notice requirements that an employer may be subject to, which means that it may not you might have to get 60 days notice as opposed to it being immediate, which is obviously much better for the workforce.
We're talking with Alexia Kulwick about getting laid off and what to do if you do get laid off. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email a question or comment to us at ideas@wpr.org. Alexia, if you've received an announcement about layoffs at your workplace, it's so natural to feel really overwhelmed or angry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. You worry about the future. So what do you recommend? What's the first thing you should do after you learn that this is coming? You're being let go.
Right. I think it is a very difficult situation. We all put so much into our work, our livelihoods, and it's a huge part of our own self-identity and who we are in our community. I think once one has calmed down, one of my first pieces of advice would be to determine You know, talk to HR, find out what timing looks like. Make sure that you discuss your potential benefits and your potential options as this takes place. In other words, are there options for it to be over a length of time as opposed to being immediate? Are you going to be receiving any kind of severance benefits? Are there any other additional benefits that the employer will be offering you because of your layoff? A lot of times also employers privately do offer some sort of retraining or other benefits to its workforce as they're transitioning. And another thing that I would also recommend in particular that people do within, this is just within HR, within their own employer, is to make sure they understand the process for applying for COBRA health benefits if the employer is not going to continue any health benefits and they do have those benefits, so that at a minimum, the employee has to pay for that health insurance, but you will still maintain benefits for some period of time, 18 months if you choose to continue making those payments. So even if you're not working, you can maintain health care.
And I want to ask you a little bit more about the health care issue in a little bit, but I want to go to the phone. We have Marcus with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So it's a piece of advice that my great uncle told me. It came from my great grandfather. During the Depression, my great grandfather was a butcher. My great uncle said that you should always have a skill, like a trade. So whether it's fixing bikes or hanging drywall, plumbing, electrical, whatever, so you have something to fall back on, go pursue the career you want to and go with the education, because I believe education is definitely important and, you know, aim high. But also you need to be flexible, and because you never know, getting laid off, you might find that there's actually something where you fall into a job that you love. And if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life.
Thank you for that, Marcus. That's great advice. Alexia, what do you think about what Marcus had to say?
Oh, well, first and foremost, I agree completely. Thank you, Marcus, for sharing that. I also want to say that, you know, looking at the trades is a smart idea, regardless of whether you consider it your quote unquote backup, right? So he was saying, pursue what you really want to do in your education. But I think that I would add that we do need more folks in the trades. And depending on, say, what your degree was in your education, you can actually sometimes do better working in the trades financially than other sort of jobs that might be available. And so it really is. I do encourage folks to take a look at them, take a look at union apprenticeship training programs. It can be a really nice pathway into something different where you can make a decent living.
What do you recommend then for people who are thinking about which way to go? I mean, is a job center a good place to start to talk about career counseling or directly to schools? Where can people kind of weigh their options?
Yeah, well, I think I do like the idea of sort of career counseling, so to speak. If you really don't know what you want to do, you know, take a look at what's out there, what sort of jobs you're seeing posted on various internet sites, for example. Do some research on what industries look like they may be hiring in the near future, which is, you know, why I mentioned the building trades. I will say that if you're laid off and you don't have a specific trade or skill, in addition to just sort of exploring what those programs, there may be something available to you through the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, where they can have you speak with a vocational expert of some sort, and you might be able to find some new trade. And you may be able to test some things out. I mean, if you're talking the trades, just prepare that for 1 second. You know, you could go talk to someone in the local union that's there, or, you know, sit in on a class and see if it might be something you like. And you could do that with other jobs as well. I mean, the old like investigatory interview, right? So just sort of interviewing, not necessarily when a position is available, but so that you can determine whether it might be something you're interested in.
Yeah, thanks for that. Alexia, I want to circle back to the healthcare options. You talked about, you know, COBRA, where the employee pays the premium. Can laid off workers go on the government's health insurance marketplace? I mean, if they're facing,
yeah.
I mean, is that open all the time to if you have a change in your employment status? How does that work?
Sure. They can go for the government system as opposed to COBRA, and it is probably more It will probably end up being more affordable for most workers. I did mention COBRA mostly because a lot of us, of course, would want to make sure that we can maintain the same health benefits and the same treating physicians and that sort of thing. But yes, I mean, the marketplace is certainly open. And if you're unemployed, I would imagine as it's built, of course, it has different tiers based on your income, that you would have that available to you. Now, if your job situation changes and you're on one particular plan paying a certain amount of money on the government marketplace, and then you get the new job, your premiums will change, right? Like you can't just stay on that. You have an obligation to inform the marketplace or your employer that your situation has changed, but you'll still have the right to obtain benefits in that way.
Alexia Kulwick is a professor in the School for Workers at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in labor relations and employment law. She's with us to talk about what to do if you're laid off from your job. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has your workplace or your industry been affected by layoffs recently? And have you or someone in your family been out of work? What questions do you have about severance packages, health insurance coverage, or filing for unemployment? You can call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Rob Ferret, right now we're picking up the conversation with UW-Madison law professor and employment expert Alexia Kulwick about layoffs and what to do if you're unexpectedly facing a job loss. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been let go from your job recently? Are you looking for work now? Or maybe you have some advice to share about navigating unemployment. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Alexia, we were talking about the health insurance stuff, and one thing I want to talk about is the severance package. Yeah. Can you negotiate your severance package, or is it always set in stone? And is healthcare something that you could actually negotiate as part of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is the thing to do.
Yeah. So it is not set in stone, and generally, or I guess I will say commonly maybe, an employer will announce a layoff and it will offer a particular severance package to the employees. It may just be some extension of salary or wages. It may contain some sort of health benefits. It may not. I think negotiating for continuation of benefits for some period of time is a really great idea. If it's not in the severance package, it's certainly something that an employee should and can demand of their employer and start to try to negotiate the severance agreements. I do see them often provided to employees as though they're a done deal, but they absolutely can be negotiated, and I encourage people to try to negotiate these agreements. I want to mention that it's not simply out of the employer's, good heart that they offer these severance packages. They almost always contain some sort of a general release of any alleged claim that a worker may have against its employer. In other words, in exchange for these severance benefits, perhaps continuation of salary for some time, perhaps a lump sum of money, perhaps health benefits. The exchange there is that the employee is not going to be bringing any kind of an alleged action against the employer for, say, alleged discrimination or some new claim that they had not yet filed with a government agency or with the court system. So there really is something that the employer gains through these agreements. And I think employees often overlook that and think they don't have any negotiating power at all.
I've heard stories of employees being asked to sign severance documents right away on the spot. Is there a length of time that companies legally have to give you to review a severance agreement? Can you say, I need to look this over, I want to have an attorney look it over? Is that okay?
Yeah. What's interesting is they could, now I get so like nitpicky, right? But technically they could say, this is your severance package, take it or leave it. However, many of the releases that an employer seeks out of a severance package will not be available to that employer if they do it immediately like that. What do I mean? Specifically, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act does require that the employer give the employee 21 days to consider the offer and actually 7 days that they could actually change their mind. It also specifically allows for employees to have the opportunity to consult with an with an attorney. So while technically an employer could try to ram this down an employee's throat, so to speak, or demand that it be done right away, it would not be a very effective agreement for the employer. And for that reason, I think we don't see it an awful lot. I do think employees need to understand that they have the right to take time to look it over. They have the right to contact an attorney and to really think about it and potentially make a counter offer or try to negotiate the agreement.
Let's go to the phone. We have Aaron with us from Madison. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I had wanted to just make a comment about an interesting situation where folks that are working remotely get laid off. And one thing that I discovered when I was recently laid off was that my employer was paying unemployment tax to a different state than the state that I was paying income tax. So I am right now collecting unemployment from a state that I was not working in because that's where the employer was paying the unemployment tax. So I just thought that was kind of interesting, and it actually turned out that I'm getting paid more in the state of Illinois than the state of Wisconsin, so it worked out great for me. And then the other comment I wanted to make quickly was just that as it relates to severance, folks should still apply for unemployment immediately, regardless of whether or not they're getting a severance, because some states will not count that against you as it relates to still being able to collect unemployment.
Oh, thanks, Aaron. Alexia, do you know what the law says in Wisconsin about that? Should you apply right away for unemployment?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree that you should apply for unemployment right away. Now, there are times that you wouldn't be denied unemployment benefits because of a severance, package, but you might receive less benefits, right? Mm-hmm. So, and once in a while, I've seen it, an employer even suggest that they want to provide the severance benefits and have the employee not apply for unemployment benefits. That's not as common, and I would caution people against that unless the severance deal is particularly great, right? Because the employer in that case is trying to avoid any kind of an increase in rates of their own unemployment insurance payments that they have to make. I'll also say I love that this worked out for Aaron, but it's kind of interesting. The employer really should be paying into the system in which the employee is employed, meaning where they are. It's interesting, the remote work, but I love that it worked out for someone. So I think, you know, it was a really interesting comment about that you are receiving the benefits in the state in which your employer is paying unemployment taxes into. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Thanks for that. We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to ask some more questions too. What should you do if you suspect you're being laid off illegally, for example, on the basis of age, race, gender, or maybe you've recently reported harassment? What's the next step?
Yeah. So I'm going to answer that as though you had not just included harassment in your list.
Okay.
And just say that as a general rule, what I would say is if you believe that there is a causation here, that there is a connection between why you were the one chosen versus someone else based on an illegal reason, meaning you're in a particular protected class, you can either go to the EEOC, which is the federal agency that enforces employment law, or you could go here in Wisconsin, you can go to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development Equal Rights Division and file a claim that they will start investigating. So you may, depending on the circumstances, you know, if there's very good severance benefits involved, or if a severance package has been offered and you feel that there may have been an illegal, discriminatory, or retaliatory motive, you know, you may want to consider that as part of your negotiations for better severance. I hesitated at the beginning concerning harassment because typically an employee should be filing some sort of a complaint with the employer's HR department or the employer's internal policy first before going to any kind of an agency to complain about potential sexual or racial harassment, for example. If the employee's already been laid off, that's not necessary. But I just hesitated because it may be something where someone's given 2 months and they may wish to complain about it within the employer's own policy that prohibits that kind of conduct even before the layoff occurs. So that's the only reason I separated those out. I'll also just say for your listeners that in general, 300 days is the amount of time between the illegal conduct and the date that someone would have to be filing something. It is 180 days in states without any kind of a Fair Employment Commission. But with DWD, employees here in Wisconsin have that full 300 days from the date that they were illegally terminated, so to speak, and the date they file any kind of complaint with an agency.
Great information. Alexia, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Alexia Kulwick, an associate professor and department co-chair in the School for Workers at UW-Madison. She teaches classes in labor relations and employment law. We've been talking about practical advice for navigating unemployment after Wisconsin and the rest of the country saw yet another major wave of layoffs last month. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. During the pandemic, the federal government expanded the child tax credit for families with dependents. And as a result, an historic amount of children were lifted out of poverty in 2021. Fast forward to 2022, however, lawmakers in Washington let the expanded child tax credit from the pandemic lapse. And the U.S. Census report showed the child poverty rate went back up that year more than 12%. A new bipartisan bill the House of Representatives passed last week, by a large margin, by the way, seeks to expand the child tax credit once again. It wouldn't be quite as significant as the pandemic policy, but the bill also includes measures to restore some tax cuts for businesses, as well as improve access to low-income housing. But in this next conversation, we're going to focus on what the re-expanded child tax credit could mean for families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did the 2021 expanded child tax credit benefit you and your family? And how did it help? Did it make a difference? If you weren't impacted by it, what thoughts do you have about the government offering that extra assistance? What do you think about Congress letting the expanded credit lapse? And did that policy ending affect you personally? We'd love to hear your story if you feel comfortable sharing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies and the Follett School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. She is also an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into this new bill, let's back up to 2021 and the early pandemic expanded child tax credit. What was the scope of it back then? What did it do?
There were two large changes to the expanded child tax credit that we experienced in 2021. One was that it substantially increased the value of that tax credit, and especially so for younger children, those under six. And then the other big change was that it delivered the tax credit monthly. So most of us are used to experiencing tax credits at tax time, but this delivered a check to families every month for 6 months from, believe, July through December. Then families were able to get the remaining value of that tax credit when they filed their taxes in 2022.
Looking back on this now, what do we know about precisely how this tax credit was able to help families? What was the impact?
So it lifted millions of children out of poverty. The child poverty rate at the time that families were getting that monthly child tax credit in 2021 was 11.5%. So just over one out of every 10 children was living in poverty. That was due in large part to the child tax credit, but also to many of the other supports that were expanded in those early years of the pandemic. In contrast, today, the child poverty rate is around 18%. So nearly two out of every 10 children is living in poverty.
What do you think was the most helpful aspect of it? Was it the fact that they were getting it every month? Was it the amount? What was it exactly that made this so effective?
Well, mechanically, in terms of affecting poverty, just putting more money in families' pockets is going to lift families over the poverty line and going to boost children out of poverty. So in terms of affecting poverty rates, just giving more money to people has that effect. I think for families, you know, their experience of it really varied in terms of what they found most useful. So for some families who are struggling to cover the bills each month, having additional money to help them do that was essential. For other families who could maybe cover the bills already, this gave them the opportunity to do some extras, right? Allow their kid to participate in an extracurricular activity or join a sports team. Those sorts of things that might have strained their budgets before, but that this additional money every month opened up the possibility of.
When you look back and you think that expanded child tax credit was so successful from a data standpoint, what were the conversations like about the renewal? Because it didn't get renewed. It wasn't made permanent. So what were some of the arguments that were happening at that time?
So there were concerns both about the budgetary implications of having that sort of expansion continue. And there were also concerns, especially from many in the Republican Party in the House and Senate, that this would disincentivize work.
What do you think about that? Do policies like this disincentivize work?
So I don't think we have a clear answer. I think the research tends to indicate that it largely does not. There is the possibility that it might allow some parents who are working full time to cut back on their hours a little bit so they can spend more time with their kids. It's a values question, whether or not we think that's preferable. And it's especially, I think, a values question when we think about the importance or not of encouraging work for the parents of the youngest children, who often face a trade-off between their childcare options, both in quality and the expense of those options, against employment. So I don't think we've seen strong evidence that it does decrease employment, but I also think it's a values question whether or not we ought to be as concerned about employment.
When that tax credit lapsed, what did we revert to? So what's the existing picture right now?
So the way the child tax credit works now is that if your earnings are very high or very low, you don't get it at all. For families in the middle, they can get up to $2,000 per year per child as a tax credit. But among families who do get it, those whose earnings are kind of at that lower end, they only get a portion of that $2,000. So they don't get the full value of the credit. So just as an example, a single parent with one child has to earn nearly $25,000 a year to get the whole value of the tax credit. We have to keep in mind that someone who works full time at minimum wage for the whole year only earns $14,000. So there are many earners who are not earning enough to get the full value of the credit. In fact, about one in four children live in families that don't get the full credit because their earnings are too low.
We mentioned in the intro that the child poverty rate increased again, and we talked about that a little bit already. Are researchers or policy makers sure there is a causal link here? I mean, do we know that the uptick in childhood poverty directly correlated with the ending of this credit?
So what the poverty rate calculates is how much income families have coming in. And when we calculate it certain ways, we count the value of taxes and transfers, like refundable tax credits, such as the child tax credit. And so we can see mechanically that removing this money from families' annual income pushes them below that poverty line. And so it's a pretty clear link between those two.
We're talking with Sarah Halperin-Meekin about the expanded child tax credit that is under consideration right now at the federal level. You can weigh in too, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Plenty of time to give us a call. When you look at this new bill, what precisely would it change on the tax credit front? Would it go back to giving those monthly payments, or are we going to again see it at the end of the year at tax time?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the new legislation proposes to do two primary things. One is to expand who can get the full value of the credit to include more earners. And the other is that it sets the full value of the credit to rise with inflation, because the value of the credit gets undermined over time if it's not adjusted as other prices rise with inflation. It also creates a look-back provision, and that allows tax filers to use this year's or last year's income to determine their tax credit size. That's a little bit in the weeds. It's mostly only useful to people who have a lot of instability in their earnings. But to your question, this does not create a monthly child tax credit again. So this would work the way the child tax credit has worked for years, which is when you file your taxes at tax time, this would get factored into either cutting your tax burden or increasing the size of your tax refund.
Do you ever see a scenario in which we would ever go back to seeing those monthly payments again?
There are certainly advocates who are interested in seeing that happen. There's not much that makes it through Congress these days. So the fact that this legislation has made it through on a bipartisan basis, I think, is really notable. But I wouldn't expect to see that kind of change soon.
And if this bill passes, is it going to be a permanent change, or is there another sunset provision here?
This is actually a really short-term bill. So these are temporary changes that would only last through 2025.
That's it. So at that point, then Congress would have to take it up again.
Yes, as with many of the other tax laws that we have on the books, they sunset after a few years, often for budgetary reasons. So I think we would again see this sort of discussion about both business tax credits and the child tax credit coming up again in a couple of years.
So that's the reason why these aren't permanent. It's because it's because of the budget. I mean, or is it because they just want to have a chance to see how it works? I mean, what's the general thinking there?
I think there are probably different reasons for different people. It's certainly affects how we think about things when we get to consider short-term budget numbers. And we can also be a bit more confident about those short-term budget numbers than when we need to project out, say, 10, 20, 30 years.
We're talking with Professor Sarah Halperin-Meekin from the Department of Human Development and Family Studies and La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We're talking about an effort in Congress to re-expand the child tax credit and how that could impact families around the country. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Do you want to see this child tax credit expanded again? And what do you want to know about how it would work or who would be eligible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sarah Halpern-Meakin from UW-Madison about the House-passed bill that would, among other things, expand the child tax credit. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. When we're talking about these child tax credits, does it only count for families with children younger than 18, or can somebody get that if their child is in college? What's the nuts and bolts about that?
Yeah, so they need to be 17 or under to qualify for this particular tax credit. Obviously, those rules can get complex from tax credit to tax credit. They're not consistent across all tax credits, but for the child tax credit, we're looking at 17 and under.
I understand there are some groups already making projections about how this new potential expanded child tax credit could impact things like child poverty rate. So what more can you tell us about that? Who would benefit and what impact would you expect that this legislation would have?
So from the projections I've seen, we'd be looking at around 16 million children whose families' earnings are too low to qualify for the full tax credit currently would start to receive that full amount. And as this is phased in over 2024 and 2025, that would be expected to lift about 500,000 children over the poverty line and boost family incomes for another 5 million children who are living in poverty. So that adds up to about a 5% cut in child poverty. That's certainly nothing to poo-poo, but it's when we compare it to the 35% cut in child poverty that we saw with the temporary expansion of the child tax credit in 2021, it's a smaller change to the child poverty rate.
And there has been criticism from some Democrats for the bill that says it doesn't go far enough to support low-income families. And there's some speculation about whether or not this will pass because some Democrats are saying we're not going to vote for it unless it does more. If you had lawmakers' ears, what would you like to see policy improvements? What would you like to see done?
So when I would speak to policymakers, I'd share information with them. I think they need to represent the values of their constituents. And some of those values might lead to support for this bill. Some might lead to opposition. You know, we've seen both bipartisan support for this bill as well as bipartisan opposition for different reasons, that opposition. So I think I would want to share the sort of information we've been talking about today, the kind of impact we would expect it to see on child poverty and the reasons why we might think it's useful to have families put more money, be able to have more money to spend on their children. It's up to policymakers, right, to weigh those benefits against any concerns that they have with the bill or against any sort of values-based opposition that they might have.
You know, just picking your brain a little bit, I guess if these tax credits don't continue, or even if they do, what are some other things that could reduce child poverty?
So some states have actually started creating their own child tax credits. 14 states, including our neighbors over in Minnesota, have a child tax credit. Wisconsin does not currently have a child tax credit. This actually includes a wide range of states, so it's not just the states that are typically more left-leaning. Idaho, Oklahoma, Utah have child tax credits as well. So that's one way, thinking about state policy levers that we can push to try to support families. In general, when we think about child poverty, we can think about ways to increase the amount of income that families have, and we can also think about ways to decrease the amount of costs that families face, because that also affects the sort of living conditions that children experience. And so things that can address families' needs around food, childcare, housing, those sorts of big, big ticket items can be really influential in the quality of life that children experience, especially in families with limited incomes.
Do you have a sense of how these kinds of tax credits have changed over time? Have we gotten stingier with them? Are we more willing to give those tax credits? What's the backstory?
So we've generally seen an expansion of distribution of supports through the tax system. So the child tax credit is the one that has gotten more attention in recent years, but we've also seen the earned income tax credit be another mechanism that we have for supporting working families. And since the early 1990s, we've seen fairly substantial increases in the earned income tax credit. So both that and the child tax credit have seen big boosts over the years. And that's in contrast with some other areas of our social safety net that have shrunk. So cash welfare, what we call W-2 here, that has become a much smaller player in the social safety net compared to these tax refunds.
If this goes through, who do you think will benefit the most? Is there a specific income bracket that will see the greatest potential help here?
Yeah, so this new legislation would boost the tax credit most for families with low to moderate earnings who have 2 to 3 children. So really those folks who are, have a good amount of income coming in, but are still, really squeezed and are raising 2 to 3 children, they would see the largest gains from this proposed change to the child tax credit.
I'm really curious about this idea of paying the credit monthly versus one lump sum with the tax refund. We touched on that a little bit earlier. Is there a way that researchers or policymakers can compare those impacts and determine which might be more beneficial for families?
There would be a way for researchers to do it. You know, if we had lots of money, we could run an experiment where we give families some money, every month, and we give it to other families in a lump sum once a year. So if anybody has a lot of money and wants to run an experiment, we certainly could do that. Otherwise, what we can do is we can compare the results of smaller experiments that give monthly cash to families. There are guaranteed income experiments and those sorts of things happening in various cities in the United States. So we can look at the results from those, and then we can compare them to what we see in research that's been done on the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, which come in a lump sum. We can also compare what we saw from those 6 months of monthly child tax credit payments to what we've seen from previous years. Those comparisons are not exact the way that we'd be able to do an experiment, but they can offer us some insights at least into starting to perhaps answer that question about how a lump sum versus monthly money works differently.
What are you going to be watching for as this bill waits to get some attention from the Senate?
I'm going to be looking to see what kind of support senators indicate. So we've already heard from our senators here in Wisconsin, some indications that Senator Johnson would be opposed, some indications that Senator Baldwin would support it. That actually doesn't follow with how things broke down during party lines on the House vote for the Wisconsin representatives. So I'll be looking to see what they indicate. But the Senate could also decide they want to make some changes to this legislation. And so we don't know what it'll ultimately end up looking like and what would ultimately go back to the House if the Senate passed something that was substantially different.
Well, we'll be watching for sure. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halper-Meekin is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies and the Follett School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW. We talked to her today about a bill the House passed overwhelmingly last week that would expand the child tax credit and how that could benefit families in the United States and throughout communities in Wisconsin. Last week, we spoke with a guest about the benefits of keeping a journal, and we heard from plenty of listeners, too, who shared their own perspectives about journaling and what it means to their lives. Renee wrote in and said she's been journaling for 52 years without missing a single day. It's become a part of her nighttime routine. She jots down mundane things like the weather, but also writes openly about her feelings. For Renee, journaling gives her permission to kind of set that day aside and move on to the next. And at the same time, her writing has become valuable to her family as well. I guess journaling can really help you make sense of how you're feeling, to work through your troubles or record your successes. And the process of writing down your thoughts as honestly and with as little judgment as possible, it seems, allows for self-discovery. And we could all use a little of that. This is Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a Shakespeare scholar about what makes his story so adaptable. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about food tradition.
Cooking can help us stay connected to our roots, our family's culture. That's the case for Mara Rintamaki of Oshkosh, who grew up in Brazil. Maria Brunetta brings us the story of the restaurant owner and one of her favorite dishes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
It's lunchtime. The scent of bobó de camarão, the special of the day, fills the air. The relaxing sounds of bossa nova play in the background. I'm transported to my beautiful home country of Brazil when I look around the vibrant and colorful restaurant. Brazilian restaurants in Wisconsin are rare. In Milwaukee and Madison, there are traditional steakhouses which offer an elaborate all-you-can-eat experience. But Mara's Brazilian cuisine in downtown Oshkosh encapsulates the feeling of going to my grandma's house for a Sunday lunch.
It's funny because here in the U.S., I feel like everybody that ever hear about Brazilian food, they stereotype with barbecue, right? The churrasco, it's what it's known for.
That's Mara Rintamaki, owner of Mara's Brazilian cuisine.
I'm the completely opposite of the standard Brazilian stereotype here in U.S. I actually do the home cooking meals, the meals that you eat in your mama and your grandma's house in Brazil, and that's the food that I want to show people a little bit more about the culture, you know, and the ethnicity of Brazil.
Rintamaki has been living in the U.S. for over 15 years. She quickly discovered her friends loved her cooking. Her specialty is cheese bread, or pão de queijo, a delectable baked ball made of tapioca flour and cheese. She started selling it at the farmer's market.
Eventually, the little dream became a little bigger dream, and I opened the restaurant, and it was beyond the cheese bread.
Now, Mara's Brazilian cuisine offers Brazilian home-cooked meals like feijoada, the national dish of Brazil. There's also stroganoff, made the Brazilian way.
I know beef stroganoff is from so many other countries, right? But we cook a little bit different. We make the beef stroganoff with white rice, and then we serve with potato sticks, and it's a big comfort food.
The stroganoff is made with small mushrooms or hearts of palm, one of my favorite additions to the dish. For me, what really ties the dish together is the potato sticks. It's a necessity that adds a crunchy bite to the meat and the rice. For Rintamaki, the ingredients give the dish the taste of home cooking.
in reality, it's just the same food that they cook every day, but it's with the Brazilian flair. I use like hearts of palm. I use palm oil. I use a little bit of different ingredients that make that home cooking just, you know, Brazilian.
Beef stroganoff is one dish that immediately brings me back home. It's typically made with either chicken or beef in a table cream and ketchup sauce. The ingredients create a creamy and tangy flavor unlike anything else I've ever had. The Brazilian community in Wisconsin is still relatively small, but it's growing. I grew up in southern Wisconsin after moving from Brazil in 2008. There, we found a community that became our family, much like what Rintamaki has found in northern Wisconsin. And she keeps an open door at Mara's Brazilian Cuisine for anyone who wants to become a part of her community.
Come to Mama. I come here and have some big plate of feijoada, which is the black beans. I will make you feel like you're home, and I will not make you feel alone. I come here anytime.
That story was produced by Maria Brunetta, a Wisconsin Life production assistant and UW-Madison student. And the feature is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
In December, Sony's romantic comedy Anyone But You debuted in theaters nationwide. It's the latest in a long line of hit films adapted from the works of Shakespeare. In fact, he holds the world record for being the most filmed author in any language. A Shakespeare scholar is with us to talk about what makes the Bard's work a hit across time, space, and medium. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite Shakespeare play that you've read or seen? And what's your favorite screen adaptation of his work? Do you think his plays work better on stage or on screen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica Moulton is an assistant professor in the Literature, Writing, and Film Department at UW-Whitewater, where she studies adaptation, screenwriting, and film history. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start off with the most recent adaptation of Shakespeare's work, Anyone But You. This was based on Much Ado About Nothing. What did you think of it?
I enjoyed the film quite a bit. I saw it this past weekend, and I really liked how it sort of took elements of Shakespeare's work, the kind of enemies to lovers plot, and transposed it to a lot of the sort of trappings we would expect to see in a modern rom-com. So I thought it was very cute and charming.
What are some of your favorite direct film adaptations of Shakespeare's plays?
Well, probably the one that I love the most is Orson Welles' film from 1965, Chimes at Midnight. Maybe slightly less well-known, but it sort of mashes up the Henry IV plays with little bits of Henry V and Richard II and a little dash of Merry Wives of Windsor. And it's sort of Wells trying to tell the story of Henry IV as he sort of ascended to power and the kind of triangle that it develops between him and his son, Prince Hal, and the sort of errant Lord Falstaff, who sort of corrupts the young prince. But yeah, it's a really spectacular film made on this kind of shoestring budget with Wells sort of financing it by appearing in bad European films. And he sort of went back and forth, you know, with the cast, bringing them back to Spain where they filmed it. And out of all of this chaos, this incredible portrait of these three men and emerges. And there's also this amazing commentary on the Vietnam War that's sort of built into the film. So I would highly recommend people seek it out if they have not seen it before.
I have not seen it. I'll put it on my list. Thanks. I'm curious, like, from your point of view, what makes a successful Shakespeare adaptation? What's the recipe like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for me, there's sort of two main factors. One is if the filmmaker and the sort of actors embodying the characters have a really defined take on the character, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think part of the joy of having Shakespeare plays, you know, seeing them on stage and seeing them on film and just seeing multiple adaptations is you get people sort of getting multiple bites at the apple. And there's so much to sort of, you know, grapple with in Shakespeare's texts that there are so many different interpretations of the characters. So that for me is really interesting. If the kind of interpretation of the character is something that I haven't seen before. And then I'd say for film, the other part of it is there a kind of interesting visual take on the material. Some of my favorite adaptations, like Julie Taymor's Titus, which is another kind of lesser known of Shakespeare's plays, has this really, really bold visual take on the material. It sort of mashes up all the periods of Roman history. So you have sort of like punks next to people in togas, next to people in sort of like Mussolini gear. It's a really, really interesting interpretation of that play.
Do you feel like there's anything that really has to stay the same in an adaptation? Or maybe it depends on whether you're doing a director-inspired adaptation.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. It's sort of I'm perfectly happy with either. Again, I think it sort of just depends on how inspired the inspiration is. You know, sometimes something like 10 Things I Hate About You does a really good job of taking The Taming of the Shrew, which, you know, on its face is kind of a misogynistic play, has pretty regressive views towards women, and actually kind of turns it into, you know, I'm not going to say like a incredibly bold feminist statement, but a kind of, you know, quietly feminist film about this teenager that, you know, is perceived by the outside world as a kind of shrew, as this sort of, you know, nasty, you know, woman. And the film sort of says, well, there's nothing wrong with her. Like, that's the whole point is, you know, he doesn't need to tame her at all. She's fine just the way she is.
We talked a little bit about setting and how, you know, that can be changed a little bit. And one of the popular direct adaptations of Shakespeare's work is Baz Luhrmann's version of Romeo and Juliet. This is set in a modern-day beach town. Guns instead of swords, right? So here's a clip of Leonardo DiCaprio as Romeo.
Mercutio's soul is but a little way above our heads. Stay for thine to keep him company.
Thou wretched boy, shalt with him hand.
Thou, or I, or both must go with him. Either thou, or I, or both must go with him. Either thou or I or both must go with them!
Oh, man. It was a great movie. But what does it say about Shakespeare's work that we're just able to switch up the setting so freely? And, I mean, what is changing the setting do to the story in this and other examples?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one, especially the Romeo plus Juliet. I think that one, it allows the plays to sort of speak to new audiences. I think that's one of the main things that is so appealing about switching up the time and the place is you get to sort of comment on so many things that are built into the play, but then sort of can appeal to, you know, an issue of the moment. I mean, I think Baz Luhrmann is really canny taking these sort of MTV visuals and kind of trying to, you know, have young people in 1996 sort of relate to those characters. That one is an interesting one, though, because I think in some ways it doesn't really make a ton of sense with Romeo and Juliet, sort of what's happening. I mean, I get a lot of joy out of that film. I think that film is really fun. The feuds between, like, warring corporate CEOs,
maybe
I'm not sure, like ancient grudge breaks into mutiny. Like, it kind of makes sense. It also kind of, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense that they would have like roaming gangs of their sort of
so true.
Nephews fighting so in the streets. But, you know,
We're with Erica Moulton. She's assistant professor in the literature, writing, and film department at UW Whitewater, talking about film adaptations of the works of Shakespeare and why they're so popular. We'd love to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes these plays so special, or are you skeptical of Shakespeare's work? 800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Erica Moulton, assistant professor in the Literature, Writing, and Film Department at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about film adaptations of the works of Shakespeare and what makes them successful. You can join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica, I'm really curious from an educator standpoint, if these films really help teachers better communicate what Shakespeare is all about for students of really any age.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I personally find them incredibly useful. For one thing, I think, you know, putting sort of faces to the sort of words on the page helps the characters come alive so much more effectively. It's always great when there are productions, like theater productions of the Shakespeare plays sort of happening at the same time. But, you know, the films are sort of always there. And then showing students different versions of the plays also kind of demonstrate to them the flexibility of the text, that there are kind of multiple interpretations of these characters and their motivations and the resonance of these stories. So yeah, I use them in the classroom all the time.
Well, yeah. And I mean, are there things we can achieve with film that maybe you can't on stage or on the page?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that kind of gets to one of the kind of enduring appeals of Shakespeare's text, which is the characters are so vibrant and there are so many kind of complex psychological motivations that you can sort of get at in film with using film techniques, using voiceover, using just the language of the camera to convey that, you know, doesn't really exist on stage. And there are a lot of scholars of Shakespeare's work that sort of look at his plays and actually sort of think of them in cinematic terms. You know, compared to a lot of the other Elizabethan playwrights, he tended to switch scenes far more often. So, you know, people have sort of interpreted that as him almost desiring a kind of cross-cutting, that he could kind of cut between different conversations happening at the same time. So I think the plays themselves often really lend themselves to cinematic adaptation.
And why else are Shakespeare's works so popular, and why do they persist through time and medium? I mean, it's years and years and years, and these, you know, it still resonates with audiences.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think a lot of it is just maybe down to personal preference. I mean, I know that, you know, obviously it has a long kind of cultural endurance, but it also, you know, Shakespeare's plays provoke such strong reactions in people. You know, I know a lot of my students just really, really hate the plays. You know, they have this sort of, this kind of perfect kind of cultural, you know, they're sort of on a pedestal in a way. For me, again, I think it comes down to the characters and even the archetypes that are in the plays. So like the quarreling lovers and the power-hungry tyrants and the wise fools, those characters can almost be removed from the plays. And they're so pervasive in the kinds of stories that we tell to each other, and they kind of apply, you know, across cultures and across time and across nations. So that just lends it to, you know, them constantly being recycled and renewed. But yeah, no, I mean, I think there is also the sense that he provokes such strong reactions to people, and that kind of helps keep it alive. The kind of ongoing debate as, you know, do these plays really matter? Do they actually speak to people? That, I think, kind of foments the flames of the debate about Shakespeare.
I'm really curious about how you were introduced to Shakespeare in the first place. Was this something maybe in high school, or did you always love it?
Well, my mom gave me her Riverside Complete Works of Shakespeare when I was probably maybe around 10 or 11. So I was introduced to it through just reading the plays. And I don't think I really understood them that well at that age. I think I was a very theatrical child. I loved being in plays and performing. And so I just really loved reading the you know, kind of poetry, the language. And then when I was about 12, I was in a production of Hamlet as Gertrude. And that was also just kind of an early awakening moment. Getting to embody those characters on stage was so much fun. And that just sort of sparked a kind of ongoing love of theater. I acted in theater all through high school, and then I think sort of through film and in college, that really helped keep my love of Shakespeare alive.
Do you feel like your understanding of Shakespeare was influenced by screen adaptations as you were growing up? I mean, did it help you kind of get more of a comprehensive view of his work?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Certainly a play like Richard III, I remember when I first read it, you know, I sort of understood it in sort of the sort of large terms, like, oh, this is sort of this evil character who's sort of power hungry and kind of systematically takes out members of his family. But seeing the Ian McKellen version from 1995, directed by Richard Longcrane, to me, that really helped kind of crystallize some of the themes of the play, that it's not just about evil, it's sort of about the ways in which, you know, society kind of corrupts itself. And Ian McKellen takes the play and sort of sets it in a kind of alternate reality, 1930s fascist England, and sort of makes it very clear that, that, you know, Richard and his ability to sort of rise and, you know, ascend the kind of rungs of power is very much because he's enabled by the society that creates him. And so for me, that was a really kind of illuminating moment.
Yeah. Well, the romantic comedy genre has, of course, seen some of the most popular movies inspired by Shakespeare's work. We talked about this a little bit, but I want to play a clip from 10 Things I Hate About You. This, of course, was adapted from Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew.
I hate the way you talk to me and the way you cut your hair. I hate the way you drive my car. I hate it when you stare. I hate your big dumb combat boots and the way you read my mind. I hate you so much it makes me sick. It even makes me rhyme. I hate it. I hate the way you're always right. I hate it when you lie. I hate it when you make me laugh. Even worse when you make me cry. I hate it when you're not around and the fact that you didn't call. But mostly I hate the way I don't hate you. Not even close. Not even a little bit. Not even at all.
That's Julia Stiles. She was reciting her character's take on Shakespeare's sonnet 141. Talk a little bit about how modern romantic comedies have been influenced by Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean, I think both Taming of the Shrew and Much Ado About Nothing really set the kind of template for modern romantic comedies. The sort of sparring lovers is just such a kind of consistent trope throughout the history of romantic comedies. And in particular, I mean, like I said, 10 Things I Hate About You, you know, has this, the play itself, you know, has this really misogynistic view of women that, you know, that they need to be tamed. And, you know, you sort of see that in some adaptations like Kiss Me, Kate, which is sort of takes the Taming of the Shrew and, you know, creates a musical around it, but has this sort of play within a play. But yeah, Much Ado About Nothing sort of, for me, is the true template, because it's sort of about this kind of skirmish of wit, which is actually a quote from the play that's actually cited in Anyone But You, which I thought was really clever. The film kind of takes little bits and pieces of the Shakespeare text and embeds them in the visuals of the film. And the thing that's great about Much Ado About Nothing is it's about this skirmish of wit of equals, that it's about the man and the woman sort of both having a lot of issues, you know, things they have to get over, sort of getting in front of themselves, or, you know, when it comes to try to finding love. But it is ultimately about the two of them kind of coming together and meeting their match, which I would say is sort of, you know, the kind of consistent template for almost all rom-coms.
Erica, I want to thank you for joining us today. I've got some movies on my list now that I must see. So thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Erica Moulton is an assistant professor in the Literature, Writing, and Film Department at UW-Whitewater. She talked with us about what makes Shakespeare's work a hit across time, space, and medium, especially film. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, families are paying 25% more for groceries now than they did before the pandemic. We'll discuss what's behind those high prices and examine some potential solutions. And some workers say their employers aren't loyal enough, but many business leaders say the same about the people they manage. We'll talk with a writer and explore some ways to perhaps mend loyalty in the workplace on both sides of that debate. That is all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.